Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're speaking to the journalist, talk radio host and author James O'Brien. O'Brien has been a dazzling star on London's LBC radio, now enjoyed the world over, since 2004, where he's carved a niche as the liberal voice of a station that's had its share of illiberal ones. More perhaps than the makeup of LBC is the genre itself, the radio phone-in that attracts, baits and plays with the concerns of White Van Man and his poor benighted pals. O'Brien has stood apart, making a particular name for himself as, in talk radio circles, seemingly the only person with genuine bandwidth to ask listeners, for example, why on earth they'd voted for Brexit. For this, and his stance on racism, homophobia, immigration and Islamophobia, O'Brien has become something of a darling for the scant liberal listenership. He would not go hungry at any dinner party in Islington or Hampstead, you might very well say. But O'Brien's skill is not in mere table turning and point scoring. He's not serving up cold dollops of schadenfreude, but rather interrogating, patiently and mostly charmingly, the positions of angry callers, or better still, those that are positive they're right. Many pennies have dropped on the airways and also in book form. O'Brien's hit bestseller, How to Be Right in a World Gone Wrong, was culled very much from his show and was excellent with it. His latest, out last week, is titled How Not to Be Wrong, The Art of Changing Your Mind. And while it necessarily nods to his radio programme, it's a more personal book and perhaps more enlightening because of it. It's funny, infuriating and even rather moving. But really, O'Brien's superpowers are still listening, language, and patience. So here is James O'Brien to tell us how not to be wrong.
The lesson I unexpectedly took away from the first book and from years doing this job was a mystification about the stubbornness of some people. You know, there's quite a lot of psychological research that's been done into the double down theory and the idea that, you know, it's a lot easier to persuade someone of something that's not true than it is to subsequently persuade them that they've been fooled. And I was fascinated by this, and possibly even a little bit aloof or even condescending in thinking, well, look at these thickos, or look at these boneheads who won't change their mind even when they're presented with so much evidence. But as ever, Orwell was there first with the line about ignoring the evidence of your eyes and ears and just, you know, believing what the party told you. And I didn't think I was remotely like that. In fact, I probably a couple of years ago would have passionately argued that I couldn't be further away from that mindset. And then when I got the opportunity to write the second book, I thought, how else can I get inside the minds, the unchangeable mind? How else can I get inside the unchangeable mind, the people that are still claiming that they support X, even though it's turned out to be Y? I mean, how do you cling so furiously? How can you end up welded to something that is not just wrong, which might be a subjective position, but harmful, which is not subjective? It hurts you. It hurts people around you. And I began to think, well, maybe the only way I could do that is by using myself as the example. And I'll try and work out why I have ended up in adulthood wedded or even welded to ideas that I know are hurtful and therefore quite possibly wrong. And because I sort of started on therapy about 2 years ago in circumstances that weren't very conducive to a positive experience, I went along because this belief that I could talk my way out of trouble had just proved utterly inadequate to a challenge I was facing in my family. So, you know, I went along expecting to laugh my head off, to be honest with you, or to at least get some material for the radio show. And it worked almost immediately. And first of all, I learned that it didn't do me any harm mindset, which explained so much about me and my failures to be more rounded and more helpful. And then I started thinking about other things and thought, well, why don't you dig into the background of that? So you've always had an issue with marriage. You've always sort of come over a little bit Ian Duncan Smith when you're discussing marriage. And I know that upsets people. It hurts people I love because I've got family members who have children who and aren't married. And I'd even there be thinking, well, you're being a dick, James. You know, they love each other just as much as you and your wife love each other. But I'd still have this weird dissonance telling me that, yeah, but it's, I used to use the phrase gold standard. And I'd say to callers, I'd say, well, it's all very well. I know you've been together for 40 years and you've got 83 children and you love each other very much, but it's not marriage, is it? It's not a gold standard relationship. And I could do it tongue in cheek and I could do it performatively, but I did mean it. Somewhere deep inside, I honestly meant it. So there's a couple of episodes in the new book where I actually phone my own radio show in a sort of fantasy.
Sort of Martin Amis sort of novel character kind of way. Like,
yeah, that's very kind. Some people might go more Alan Partridge, but I'll take Martin Amis. I'll take Martin Amis all day long. And it worked. You know, I worked out why I had an irrational antipathy towards tattoos, towards body art. And I worked out amazingly where my reverence for marriage had come from. And by working it out, I felt at the time, while writing the book, I felt my way down the mountain. I felt my way away from these ludicrous positions of stubbornness that would hurt people for no reason whatsoever.
You mention it in the new book, How Not to Be Wrong. You mentioned the public school thing. That's that sort of unthinking allegiance to an old idea. So this kind of idea of a sort of muscular Christianity and a kind of like play up and play the game kind of idea of it. But did you have your doubts when you were at school that there might be something slightly more complex than the cry God for Harry England and St. George kind of vibes that you were getting potentially off masters and teachers?
Well, I oddly and completely wrongly in retrospect, Rob, I thought I'd avoided it all. I thought I had a rich inner life and I was emotionally literate and I wrote poems and starred in the school play and won all the debating prizes. And the people who were emotionally crippled or who fit into Cyril Connolly's theory of permanent adolescence, that would be the jocks and the sportsmen or the forelock tuggers and the prefects, whereas I was this magnificent mixture of rebel and aesthete. And it turned out 30 years later that I had been just as damaged, if not more damaged, by that mindset, because I'd adopted it subconsciously rather than consciously. So I wasn't somebody standing on the touchline shouting, cry God for England, Harry and St. George. I was going to go, look at these Neanderthals. They don't know they're born. I'm off to commune with Orwell or Keats or something like that. But because it started at prep school rather than public school, the casual violence and the formal beatings that started when I was about 10, when I very reluctantly and skeptically started therapy, it emerged very, very quickly that I'd put epic amounts of effort, more effort than any 10-year-old should ever be required to do, into convincing myself that this process of punishment hadn't hurt me. Because that was the point, you see. If you're getting beaten, you have to tell yourself that it's not hurting. To admit at the time how much pain it's causing you is to give even more agency and power to the fully grown man who is, with the use of a specially designed paddle, is routinely and regularly beating small boys, beating small children. And the if that's the acorn, that the tree that grows from it is a tree of denial, so that you can, if you can talk yourself out of feeling pain when you're being beaten at 10, you think you can talk yourself out of anything. So the abandonment issue that is attendant upon boarding school becomes key here, because you talk yourself out of feeling abandoned, you know, usually by saying, well, mum and dad, for kids like me, mum and dad have made enormous sacrifices to send me here. Sending me to this school is an act of love. It's a genuine act of altruism. They want me to have things they didn't have themselves. Obviously, a lot of lads at public school come from much more privileged backgrounds than me, but I suspect they go through similar processes of self-delusion. This is not hurting. This doesn't hurt me. I don't miss home. I wouldn't rather be sitting in front of the fire with my mum's voice in my ear. I want to be. You convince yourself that you're not in pain when you are, and that, I realize, leads you to a place as an adult where if something terrible happens and this skill set you've got doesn't work, because don't be under any illusions, it often does work. In many ways, my career is contingent upon the fact that I can talk my way out of pretty much any situation whatsoever, but I can't talk my way out of a family medical crisis, or indeed Boris Johnson can't talk his way out of a coronavirus infection in the way that David Cameron said he would be able to because of the way he played tennis. And all of this, all of these planets aligned shortly after I'd begun writing the book without a clear idea of where it was going to go. And rather than just being a book about me being wrong, it became a book about why learning how my background and education had made me so wrong about me and therefore about so many other things is reflected in the ruling class. You know, it is an education, a psychological conditioning that was designed to equip us to run an empire. And it worked. It doesn't equip us to be good sons or fathers or husbands or friends, or it equips us to believe that we can talk our way out of anything, and we can't. So what I thought was my skin turned out to be armor.
You mentioned, James, the debating society there and the importance of it to sort of some of your kind of social standing and intellectual standing at school. And there was an interesting piece written in the FT Weekend this summer about the sort of importance given to the debating society, but the sort of people that flow from its success are able to take any sort of position as a game, and you can win as a game. And these people have ended up in politics. The novelist Sally Rooney, who wrote Normal People, I think it was around this time, she was on the debating society at university. Her protagonists, I believe, are. And this, we're in sort of dangerous territory where you want people that are intellectually flight on their feet, but not at the expense of belief, I suppose, not at the expense of rightness and belief. Is that, we're sort of heading down the same river there slightly?
So yeah, I hadn't spotted that parallel, but I think you're absolutely right. The way I describe it is that you can win the argument, but it doesn't mean you're right, and that's what you learn in debate. So I would used to relish actually at school the position that I didn't agree with, because I used to think A, it's a bigger intellectual and rhetorical challenge to argue against my own convictions or beliefs, but also B, look at me, Mum, no hands. I can even win debates when I don't even agree with myself. I'm so brilliant. But usually that journey, certainly into the Oxford and Cambridge debating societies, who feed so much politics, don't they? And I didn't go to either of those universities, but I see the fruits of that experience sort of going a little bit rotten on the political tree.
You quote Malcolm Gladwell, you interview and quote Malcolm Gladwell in the book, and I think he says something like, being wrong flatters me and it makes me feel young again. And I love that idea. And it seems like there was a bit of that you kind of picked up that ball and ran with it as well, because it's a great thing, right? I mean, actually, imagine if you were in your early 40s and you were right about everything. I mean, that how fun would the rest of your really great career on the radio actually be? Do you know what I mean? I mean, I wonder if you hadn't have, if this unfortunate circumstance that your family hadn't have happened and you hadn't gone to therapy and this all of this had happened, it's far from fodder for a sequel to your first book. This is something very essential, it seems to me. How much did that Gladwell quote kind of resonate while you were writing it?
I mean, absolutely. It was weird, actually, because, you know, having discovered the benefits of therapy, I then found myself getting quite spiritual about things. I've always been religious. I had a relationship with religion, but I began, there's a line that my therapist taught me that comes up in the book a lot: when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And so bizarrely, I interviewed Gladwell, I interviewed Malcolm, I got on really well with it. And I had the seed for the idea in the back. I think the publisher and I had already come up with a vague title without knowing quite what it was going to be. So I was in the habit of asking all my A-list interviewees what they had been wrong about. But Malcolm, as is his wont, went so much further than ordinary people do and actually started examining the joy of wrongness, which, you know, could have been another alternative title, actually, thinking about it. And you're absolutely right. It's rejuvenating, because what's the alternative? The alternative is to ossify. The alternative is, and don't make any mistake, this is a very lucrative career. The alternative is to keep trotting out the same old lines. Maybe you change the target. Maybe it was single mothers 20 years ago and it's immigrants today, or it was people with flat screen TVs 10 years ago and it's people who can't feed their own children today. The targets change, but the tactics remain absolutely identical. And I'd be the kind of the liberal counterpoint to that. So, you know, my targets might be people presiding over food banks today, and tomorrow it would be people not supporting striking firefighters. So you have, again, this slightly binary worldview, liberal versus illiberal, and you're always on the same side and you always make the same arguments in slightly different ways. You carry on getting paid a ton of money and everyone's great, but it's very bad for the soul. And what's very good for the soul is to really have a proper look at why you think what you think. And I think it's probably, touch wood, it's probably good for work as well, because it gives me new skills with which to examine what other people are saying and what other people are thinking. Although about halfway through my therapy, when it was clearly working, and no one was more shocked than me by how well it worked and how quickly it worked. You've got to be lucky with who you hook up with. That is something that I really stress, and I'm well aware of the fact that it's beyond many people's purse and pocket as well. But I started worrying that I was going to invent a word. I was going to therapize myself out of a job, because I was going to be so like zen and accommodating and balanced when I get back in the studio, when the process is complete, that I'll never be able to dismantle or destroy anybody ever again. And while I'm much, much slower to anger now, the important thing to remember is that even if you've spent your whole life thinking you're under attack when you're not, which was kind of my survival personality that emerged, this idea that the best way to avoid getting hurt is to punch first and ask questions later, in my case metaphorically, in many people's case actually physically. Yeah. And the thing you have to remember is that sometimes you are under attack. So I was worried that it was going to be such a complete rebirth that I would never ever feel attacked or under siege again. But of course, sometimes you are under attack. The trick is to recognize when you are and behave accordingly, not to behave as if you are all the bloody time. So the show now is a much, much warmer listen than it was 2 years ago, but I don't think that people ringing in possessed of particularly toxic prejudices and positions are going to get an easier ride than they would have. Than people ringing in confused or conflicted or a bit befuddled, they will get a much easier ride than they would have done, because I don't think I enjoy shooting fish in a barrel anymore.
No, indeed. I mean, it's neither are you yogically flying out of the studio on a daily basis, or in, possibly.
No, exactly that.
And sort of allied to that is a chapter near the end called Fatty, Fatty, Fat, Fats, which became a sort of a refrain for you. And you say in the book that one caller wrote in or phoned in and said that their daughter used it to describe some poor woman at a supermarket checkout. And you were like, I thought it was funny until about that point. And that seems to be, in a way, kind of, it tells the story in miniature of your kind of radio journey, in a way, from provoking, often from the liberal side of things, but still kind of throwing a cane in the spokes. And now you've sort of come through this other side. Was that something, as I say, does that feel like your radio journey written in very much miniature? Or is that a kind of just a slightly more random example?
No, it's a very, very good example for a whole heap of reasons. I mean, I did something else quite odd in that chapter, where I went through my monologue at the top of a show from 10 years ago, in the way that in the last book I went through calls from people possessed of positions I found absurd or disgusting. And I went through it, and I'm basically a fascist in that, albeit that the target of my bigotry is obese people, overweight people. My language, my style, the sneering, some of the verbal tactics I deploy. I could just as easily have been a well-known racist demagogue talking about Romanians or talking about Muslims. It just, I suppose, as a someone allegedly liberal, I felt at the time that going after fat people or vegetarians or dog owners or people with tattoos wasn't prejudiced in the way that going after people of color or people of a certain religion or people without a job was fascistic. And I was doing it all. I was ticking the boxes one by one. And it wasn't even, Rob, the caller who told me that her daughter had pointed at a woman in a supermarket queue and gone, "Look, mummy, a fatty, fatty, fat, fat." That wasn't my wake-up call. I thought that was great. I was proud, and I'm so embarrassed to admit this, I was proud of the cut through. I thought, that's amazing. That is evidence that my radio show is now reaching out into corners that other radio shows cannot reach. A 6-year-old is using my catchphrase. Now, if my catchphrase had been, "What do points make prizes?" like the late great Bruce Forsyth, that would have been wonderful, you know, or you know, "Nice to see you nice." But my catchphrase involved a child abusing an unhealthy and probably unwell adult. So the penny drop moment on that one was simply having somebody who'd fought her weight and dealt with weight issues all her life on a really quite grand scale, come into our lives to help with our children, to look after our children. And we all fell in love with her. And she remains a very important part of our family structure. And so the next time I'm drawing Beth, lining up to do a big spiel about how disgusting it is that so-and-so council is offering money to fatty, fatty, fat, fats to help them. Where's my money? Why aren't I? Like they talk about foreign aid, you know? Yeah. And I couldn't quite believe the parallels. I hear someone I consider despicable talking about foreign aid. And yet here I was talking about fat people in exactly the same way, particularly on the refrain about taxpayers' money that I'm using in this monologue. And I couldn't quite believe it was me. And so I tried to dig into that. I thought, where did that come from? It's got to be more than just spinning the wheel and doing a target like Orwell's 2-minute hate. There has to be a reason why it works, both for the recipient. Why did people lap it up? They still do, you know, the eat less, exercise more refrain. It's like they're an abused minority that it's okay to abuse still because it's not ethnic or a more obvious characteristic. And the more I dug into it, the more it began to make sense to me. And on that occasion, the more not liberated or rejuvenated, but the more disgusted with myself I felt.
And you mentioned there in a couple of different ways that the penny drop moments. And I wanted to ask you about that, James, because that is the moment that we are taught in radio that every time dead air is the crime of the century. These are moments that, and you know, in your monologues, you're not afraid to draw breath. You're not afraid to think live on air, and you allow your listeners and callers in to do the same. And you talk in both books about those penny drop moments. What is that like in the studio where you don't quite, I presume sometimes you don't quite know whether someone's going to come out with a barrage of abuse or they're going to go, do you know what? I hadn't thought about it like that.
It's rare as hen's teeth for it to be the actual caller in the moment doing that. It's the people listening having penny drop moments that you can almost feel. I mean, I'll give you quite a lazy example because I think it highlights what you're describing better than some of the more nuanced or subtle examples. But I had, and this is in the last book, actually, not in the new one, when I was hosting a fox hunting debate, you know, one of the old hardy perennials.
The classic, that's the schoolboy perennial.
And the death penalty, the absolute greatest hits. And we had a fella on, and we had him actually in silhouette because he was a hunt saboteur, a fully paid up hunt saboteur. And I don't know whether he needed to be in silhouette, but that's telly, that's showbiz for you. It added a little friction to proceedings. And he gave his big impassioned defense of foxes and why they didn't deserve this and why animals were sacred almost, you know, and needed protection. Their life was worth as much as humans. And I just said, is it just fox hunting that you get involved in? Or do you ever try and disrupt pest control operators getting rid of rats and cockroaches? Because their life is surely worth at least the same as a fox's. This was a disaster, Rob, because it was a TV show and the last thing they wanted was a penny drop moment. They wanted heat. They didn't want light. And it got added to, in the end, it got added to the long pile of pilots I made that never reached production because there's this awful pause. I mean, it was awful pause. And at the end of which, he just went, oh, remember, he's in silhouette. This is the beginning of the debate that's supposed to inflame the studio. Like those old late night Friday night shows on regional ITV. And he went, oh, I've never thought of it like that before. It's a very good point.
TV gold.
It was awful. So in the radio studio, you're more likely to get if someone is. I find that increasingly, I think critical race theory is the latest example. People are handed these blunt instruments, but they don't really know what they mean. All they know is what's written on the side of them. And I like to ask what that means. And one of my favorite experiences was probably with political correctness, which people so blithely drop into the conversation. And I like to just say, what do you mean by that? And they end up saying, well, I suppose I mean being good mannered and polite to each other. And you sort of go, but at the beginning of this conversation, you were portraying this as a really bad thing that was the enemy of civilization as we know it. And now we've worked out what it actually means. It sounds like quite a good thing to be, doesn't it? And then you get the pause and you get that. Well, yes, James, it does actually. So those are lovely, lovely moments as well. Yeah. But you've got to get them in the right format.
And I just wanted to ask you finally, with both of the books, I mean, one thing is the writing of them. One thing, you know, a lot of the fodder for them comes from the radio shows or or extra thinking that comes from, I presume, going home and driving home or whatever it is, and thinking about the conversations you had that day, for sure, as much as personal stuff as well, as you've kind of alluded to. When you're promoting the book, you're obviously coming up with a lot of journalists who think quite similarly to you, which is a position you're often not used to being in professionally, I suppose, with the radio show and stuff like that. Is that strange territory when you're being interviewed by suckers like me that kind of go, oh, I can agree more with you. This is brilliant. This is very similar to what I think. You must sit around having these half-hour interviews being bored out of your skull.
With the first book, that was absolutely true. And some of the most emotional professional experiences I've ever had would be at book festivals. Because a radio studio is a very lonely place. Social media is a very distorting lens. And everybody's human. So the person who's calling you a wanker is going to have a louder voice than the person who's calling you a hero in your personal psychology. And so doing the book festivals and having, you know, hundreds of people cheering you, sold out crowds. I did one in Ireland and I went on after Bono.
Not a bad warm-up, man.
Could you imagine that? And we were sold out. So not only have I got this surreal experience of sitting backstage thinking, it wasn't just Bono, Rob. It was Bono and Stephen Fry.
Brilliant.
I'd be there thinking, oh, God, the hall's going to empty. There's going to be eight people and my mum left in the room after Bono and Stephen Fry's finished. But I've already got the receipts. I've seen that we've sold out. So to be in rooms like that, I was in Dorky, in Cheltenham, in the Hay on Wye. I went there as a kid. And then I was giving the Christopher Hitchens Memorial Lecture just before the first book came out. So those moments were magical. And being interviewed by like-minded people. It was a lovely, lovely experience. But oddly, latterly, I don't get as many calls on the show from people disagreeing with me as I used to do. Because I think the big beasts have gone to sleep. I mean, the Brexit debate doesn't really work anymore in the way that it worked when I came to prominence for conducting it. So, no, I don't think I'll ever get bored of talking to simpatico people.
Well, you still, thankfully, got Piers Morgan, who you reserve the bottom position on the back of the dust jacket, who says, I barely agree with anything he says. So at least you've...
I think we have a love-hate
relationship. You've still got that one.
Yes, exactly. I've interviewed him, actually, for my podcast next week.
I've listened to lots of those, actually, and loved your first one with Tony Blair. And I did have an extra question, which was on here, which was sort of allied to the themes of both of your books, actually, which is not about white privilege, which you address in How Not to Be Wrong, the new one, but it's also, when you say, you know, when you, are you worried about white savior syndrome or whatever? Do you remember asking him that and him sort of saying, and he, I thought he was a politician who obviously was used to getting things done, an international as well as national level, and labels like that, he might have heard of it, but it would never have occurred to him that you would do anything that wasn't basically a practical thing. You know, he was trying to actually make people's lives better in Africa. It, obviously, in other parts of the world, he didn't. But it was an interesting thing. Was that a bit of a penny? That was a penny drop for me. It was just like, well, why would I care that someone said that about me? I'm trying to do something here. And there's quite a lot of language. I mean, obviously, you know, you're a fan of it. You use it. But we often get tripped up in language, which obviously Blair was great with, but at the end of the day, just a practical person there.
Yes, I mean, it's a brilliant analysis, because I was surprised by how much thought he gave to some of my questions in that interview. I was very touched, actually. I was very impressed, but because he has that reputation for being slick and for glossing over things. But hopefully, you know, if you get the questions right, it gives anybody pause. I mean, virtue signalling, again, being a brilliant example of that. So much of it seems designed to denigrate altruism or to denigrate decency. And it usually comes from media organisations that commoditise callousness and commoditise cruelty. And so I suppose their consciences, or what's left of their consciences, demand that they attack people who are trying to do the right thing. And then there is sometimes a reason to stop and think about. So the chapters in the new book, when I segue from Black Lives Matter to white privilege, I did see myself as a great champion, a great ally of the idea that Black Lives Matter. Again, they've tried to corrupt that. Now, by saying that you believe that Black Lives Matter, apparently you're calling for capitalism to be abolished and the police to be defunded. If you it listened to the same kind of people that coin phrases like virtue signaling and white savior syndrome. But sometimes you do have to check yourself, I think. And that bit of the book, it was really uncomfortable. And the radio experience it refers to was really uncomfortable because I wasn't quite as squeaky clean as I thought I was. I wasn't quite as far on the side of the angels as I thought I was. And it reminded me of Me Too, which I wrote about in the first book a lot, because it's as if the world you live in has been hiding a huge reality for other people in the same world that you've never noticed before. So when I spoke to women in the immediate aftermath of Me Too, in my personal life as well as my professional life, the simple acceptance of the permanent threat of sexual violence that women live with in our society had never actually occurred to me, except in the abstract, except as something that occasionally flares up with a specific example of a bad thing happening to someone or a bad thing nearly happening to someone. But speaking to everybody from my wife onwards, and as the father of daughters, it being a conversation I found particularly urgent, realizing just how normal and commonplace this experience was, that to me was alien and unknowable. And I had a similar experience with some of the Black Lives Matter white privilege conversations, even this year. You know, this isn't something that's filed under, filed under business completed. I realized that a little bit too quick to pat myself on the back for being right on. Whereas in fact, when someone suggests that maybe you wouldn't have your status today if you were a different color, I would bite their heads off in a form of aggressive self-defense. And so I had to stop and think about that and acknowledge. And this is why white privilege is such an unhelpful phrase in so many ways, is because it's not designed to tell people that they've had it easy. It's just designed to tell people that this is one problem you don't have. So you could still be a victim of class discrimination. Obviously, I'm not. You could still be poor. You could still be struggling. You could still be sick. You could still be dealing with this and dealing with that and dealing with that. But you're not dealing with this. And that's all it says. And it's unhelpful because in the wrong hands, and even in some well-meaning, honest, but wrong hands, it becomes you're being told that you never struggled. So I am a public school educated, middle-aged, white, high-earning heterosexual. The idea that I have struggled on a similar scale to other people is obviously absurd, but I have struggled. I have lain awake at night worrying what would happen if the wheels fell off. So that understanding all of that and understanding why, you know, again, what the ghouls and vampires would call or try to malign as something like positive discrimination is simply just opening up opportunities more widely. And I think the trick is to marry it to class, because the other person I quote at length, probably the only one who stands comparison with Gladwell in the book, is Akala, whose book Natives is just so on it. And this the whole point about a class hierarchy is that if you can persuade the people that are at the bottom of it to blame the people over there or over there instead of up there, you're golden. You know, that's the aristocracy, that's the ruling class, that's Donald Trump in a nutshell. Whereas actually, a white kid in Glasgow 30 years ago was subject to all of the privations and discriminations that a black kid in Brixton is today. And yet by framing it in terms of color, we actually help neither of them. And so I did find that really, really, that was rejuvenating. That's a really good example of feeling wrong and coming out of the experience, feeling refreshed and newly engaged, re-engaged with the matter. It's a door you've never opened before. It's a door you never noticed before, as with Me Too. And then you open it, and it might not be good news. It might be a difficult experience. But if you think of life as a palette, here's a whole new bunch of colors you never knew existed before. So if you're an artist, that's good news, right? Even if you're painting a grim picture, you've got more colors to do it with now.
My great thanks to James O'Brien, whose new book, How Not to Be Wrong, The Art of Changing Your Mind, is out now, published by W.H. Allen. Monocle on Culture is produced by Holly Fisher. Join us at the same time next week. But until then, from me, Robert Bounds, thanks for tuning in.